We'll move on to the third case of this morning, Crosspoint 7 against Manufacturers Life. Mr. McCauley?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Curtis McCauley here on behalf of the appellants in this case. With me at counsel table is my partner, Michael Wilkins. We represent InTech Partners 1 and 11 and Crosspoint 7, whom I'll collectively refer to as Loth because they're all part of the Loth Property Group, an independent development company in Indianapolis, Indiana. This case arises out of a transaction between Loth and Manulife, Manufacturers Life Insurance, which is a Toronto-based entity with a regional office in Chicago. Most of the communications leading up to the transaction at issue here were between two principals of Loth, which were Mr. Popich and Mr. Gernick, and two regional representatives of Manulife, which were Mr. Goldman and Mr. Giannini. Negotiations for the loan at issue in this case arose during May 2002 and took the form of a series of commitment letters that were negotiated several times and through several different revisions, culminating in a third amended commitment letter.
I wonder if you could initially address one point that your opponents raised, which is whether this appeal is really about just the one commitment letter about the InTech One loan or whether it's about all three, because you did have three separate letters, three separate properties, three separate transactions, and the difficulties arose only with respect to one.
Well, I would say that you can say that the difficulties were related to one, but
you have to pull one of them.
Well, yes, with respect to one tenant, but remember that tenant was also cross-collateralized, or that lease was also cross-collateralized with another one of the loans. So those two are interrelated, and these loans, all three of them, were negotiated as a package deal all through there. There's no evidence in the record whatsoever that Loth would have had any interest in going forward with this deal but for the fact that all three of them were part of it. You can look at the date of the signing of all the amendments, the interrelationship between them, the references to the other ones and discounts and doing them all together, et cetera, and that, I think that's a fairly good indication, particularly on summary judgment when all the facts are supposed to be taken in the favor of the non-moving party, i.e. Loth, that this was a package deal and everything fit together as one package.
All right. Now, the next question I have from you is, even after all of these conversations that you have recounted, Loth continues to do a lot of things, you know, actions perhaps speaking louder than words, a lot of things directed toward the September 20 closing date. They're FedExing things, they're overnighting, they're getting reports done. I don't see any indication that this is with respect to some hypothetical new deal. This is all focusing on the old deal, the existing deal.
Well, if you do pull that evidence out and take it out of context.
But I don't
and
know
not
that it is out of context. It's in the context of the time period that's relevant.
And particularly when you look at the September 9th conversation, which is where you're really hanging your hat, because that's the critical date, and all this action has taken place after that date.
Well, I guess this wouldn't be the first time in the history of corporate America where after the people at the top had decided the deal was done, the bureaucratic inertia continued on below. You also have to realize that there were discussions going on between the parties about a new deal. Popich is very clear in his testimony that after the September 9th, the conversations that he had were with respect to what kind of new deal could we do. The stuff that was still done in that case pertained to things that would be usable in any deal that would have been done, and it didn't make any sense to necessarily stop everything.
Why would you FedEx something if there wasn't some immediate time pressure there?
Oh, a lot of businesses just routinely FedEx things. Again, it seems to me that you have to do this. You have to draw all sorts of inferences from actions that are people taking that are consistent with also other courses of conduct. This is all consistent with the idea that the parties were talking about some sort of new deal. It's all consistent with Loth's desire to get out from under what they considered onerous temporary financing on these properties.
Well, what about Goldman and Giannini when the voicemail was left stating that Manulife would approve the loans as is without any additional collateral? Why didn't you believe the word, or why wasn't their word believed?
Well, first of all, that came after the September 9th conversation, which Popovich accepted the repudiation that occurred and said, look, the deal is dead from our perspective, that that's what you're doing. So
let me just insert another thought in here to put what Judge Williams is saying in context. There's law behind all of this. I mean, we'd like to think we do something with the law. And the law here is that repudiations have to be unconditional and absolute and unambiguous and so forth. And that's where I'm concerned. Of course, you're right about the way the summary judgment standard operates. But what we need to find is, even taking the inferences most favorably to Loth, that there is this kind of unambiguous end of the relationship, and the voicemail that Judge Williams is talking about, the behavior of the various agents during that week leading up to September 20th, casts a big shadow on anything. It makes it very hard to call it unambiguous.
Right. Well, you should look at the acts that were taken between the September 6th and the 9th conversations and the September 12th when Manulife came back and said, we'll do the deal as is. By the way, saying we'll do the deal as is indicates that they were trying to get some sort of better deal than what they had to begin with.
But that's the point of all this due diligence anyway. I mean, they point that out in their brief, but, I mean, frankly, you don't have to read their brief to realize that. You know, you're giving them all this information about tenants. It seems to contemplate some kind of conversation before a closing date, and sometimes the conversation might wind up with an amendment, sometimes it might not. Right. You know, but just because people are talking about it doesn't mean deals are off.
Again, you have to keep focused on the fact that these commitment letters went through those three different amendments, four different revisions, ultimately.
Right, and during that time, the last commitment letter anticipates data will be exchanged.
Not with regard to Eschen.
Well,
which is not
3 years' worth of things. It just said whatever's there, you'll get, but there's all sorts of other due diligence data that's going around.
And it's also important to note that the testimony is from the folks in Toronto that actually Manulife was not concerned at its home office with regard to the Eschen lease. There's no evidence in this case that it was the Eschen lease that was motivating what was happening here with the Chicago representatives.
Well, maybe they were off on a frolic. I mean, I don't know what they were doing, but the fact is, we're looking for clear and unambiguous evidence of the repudiation.
Well, that evidence is there in the statements that we will not go forward with the lease unless we get some sort of, or the loans, unless we get some sort of securitization for the Eschen lease, which was already negotiated out during the process of the commitment letters. There's nothing in the commitment letters that allows them to get that.
Okay. So, you're in your rebuttal time if you wish to save any.
No, I would like to save my rebuttal time.
Okay, fine. Mr. Maddens.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I am Alan Maddens, representing the defendant appellee, Manulife. I'd like to begin with the point that was discussed a little bit regarding the due diligence period that Judge Wood was talking about. Because one point that's really not covered very much in the district court opinion, and it's really glossed over totally by the borrowers here, is that for there to be a repudiation, you have to have an anticipatory breach, not an anticipatory we're thinking about doing something that we have the right to do. And here, there's a critical problem with the borrower's claim that there was an anticipatory breach or repudiation. And that is that under the restatement and under the applicable law, Manulife could have anticipatorily repudiated only if what it said it was going to do would have represented a breach of the Intec 1 commitment letter. And
well,
in fact,
that goes to how firm a commitment was this thing, because I take it that your position from your brief is that if the information that was exchanged during the due diligence period was unsatisfactory by some standard to Manulife, then the deal was off, that was an implicit condition in the letter, right?
I don't think it was implicit. I think it was explicit. For example, with respect to the Essient financials, Manulife eliminated the requirement that the borrower, as one of its obligations, supply 3 years' worth of financials. But instead, the borrower was required to provide whatever Essient and the other tenant, Sarat, I think, financials were available for Manulife's review and approval. And then at the same time as the Third Amendment is signed by the borrower and sent to Manulife, they also send this information about Essien. So Manulife is doing due diligence, as Mr. Goldman said in his transcribed voicemail of September 11. It has the right, in the course of due diligence, to decide whether it's going to go forward with the loans. And the plaintiff's implicit argument, although they never actually get there, but they have to, is that Manulife was guilty of an anticipatory breach because instead of saying, we terminate, because we're not happy about the Essien financials, instead they said, we will terminate, thinking about terminating, we're not going to fund unless we make some changes. And if that constitutes an anticipatory breach, then pretty much every commercial transaction that I've been involved in, one side or the other could argue that there's been an anticipatory breach, because that's what due diligence is all about. You find out information that's a little different from what you expected, and as a result, you tell the seller of the business or of the office building that we need more soil tests, even though they're not provided for, we're not ready. Or we need a price reduction because it turns out that there's been a termination of a lease, or the tenant that we thought was your best tenant is really not a very good risk at all. So,
okay. One thing we didn't talk about with Mr. McCauley was the repudiation idea, that even if you had said the deal was dead, the letter that was sent afterwards, the September 13th letter, I think, was sufficient to retract whatever had happened. Now, they wanted a letter from the CEO, as I recall. They wanted something from Toronto, at least, since that's where they were told that the directions were coming to get the extra security. What about that?
Well, a couple of points. First of all, the retraction actually occurred by virtue of the two voicemails to which Judge Williams referred on September 12th. It's after that that the borrower says, well, we got a lot of conflicting signals here, which is itself evidence that the purported repudiation was not unequivocal, but we've got some conflicting signals. We'd like a firm statement. And they get a firm statement the next day, but they get it from Giannini and Goldman, the people with whom they've been dealing all along, rather than from the person that they asked it of, namely the CEO of Manulife's parent corporation, sitting in Toronto knowing nothing about what's happening on this deal. And the district court properly said that that was not a reasonable request. You had a purported repudiation from these two guys in Chicago. You got the retractions via voicemail and now via this letter from those same two people, and you had no right to demand it of the CEO. And, you know, in their brief, they say, well, we wanted something from the home office. And I was struck as I was reviewing materials over the last several days that in their reply brief on page 11, they talk about the specificity of their request in their September 12th, letter to Manulife, the specificity of their request and how they didn't get what they asked for. Well, the specificity of their request was not, we'd like something from somebody in Toronto. The specificity was, we want something from the CEO. And that CEO had nothing to do with the negotiation or execution of these commitment letters. He had nothing to do with anything that had transpired.
They quoted one letter, though, that does say, we're getting this from the CEO and we don't think he's going to change his mind.
They quoted Mr. Goldman's voicemail of September 11, in which he said that these deals had been approved by the CEO and nobody wants to go back to him.
Right. So that doesn't sound like he knows nothing about it. That sounds like there's some evidence in, taken favorably to Louth, that he does know something about
it. Well, what the evidence is, which is, again, undisputed, is that the CEO's signature was required on the underwriting approval that preceded the circulation of the very first commitment letters to these borrowers. From that time forward, he had no involvement, and there's no dispute about that. And what Mr. Goldman says in his September 11 voicemail is nobody wants to go back to him. So the fact that nobody wants to go back to him when he's been out of it for several months is hardly evidence that he's involved in the process, which is how the plaintiffs would like to twist it around. Now, I do want to also cover the point about one versus three deals here, it's a fallback position for us that I'm not terribly interested in getting to, but as Your Honor pointed out, the Essien Financial is a function purely of the Intec 1 loan commitment, and we have three separate loan commitments for three separate properties owned by three separate borrowers. We don't have, as in a couple of cases that they cite, we don't have multiple contract documents forming one transaction between the same parties. It's true that they were negotiated together. It's true that the plaintiffs received some discounts in their fees and good faith deposits because there were multiple loans. But repudiation, getting back to that again, requires an unequivocal, absolute, unconditional statement. It's a harsh remedy, so that requirement is construed strictly. And there's no evidence of anything being said with respect to CrossPoint 7 or Intec 11's loan commitments as to Manulife not going forward. So how one can possibly say that because Loth liked the idea of it being a package, therefore Manulife repudiated all three when it spoke of only one, is a little hard to fathom. Unless the court has other questions, I would rest on the briefs and ask the court to affirm in full.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. McCauley, you had some time. Oh, you have lots of time, Mr. McCauley, 2.5 minutes. So
I'm time rich. very, very quickly, I want to talk a little bit about the issue with the CEO and whether really Manulife was trying to rely on the its opinion of the Essien Financials. If you look at the judge's opinion at page 6, makes it clear that the folks in Toronto advised Goldman and Giannini of the Chicago office that the loans had been approved without regard to Essien's financial situation and that Manulife was sufficiently protected by cross-default provisions and cross-collateralization between the two Intec loans. Relying, you know, Goldman and Giannini relying on Essien to say, well, we want more out of you principals, is just a pretext. And that shows it, at least on this summary judgment motion, where you have to take all the facts and draw all the inferences in favor of Loth in this case. You have to also, with regard to treating these loans as different entities and that we can pull them all apart now, you have to look at the motivation that was behind them here. The principals were on the hook for the temporary financing on each of these three properties. They needed to get out from under that on all three. They weren't interested in only a partial solution. They were interested in doing it all at once. The negotiations, everything there is very, very clear that that's what they wanted to do. Nobody treats these as separate documents until after the fact, and now we have briefing going on. Mr. Maddens talked about the conversations that occurred. Again, if you take their people's testimony about what the conversations were, maybe you could reach that conclusion, but the testimony of the Loth people who were involved in those conversations are very clear that they were demanding something and saying, we are not going to go forward with it unless you give us this additional collateral. And that demand for something that goes beyond what was allowed under the loan commitments is under the case law that we've cited, and it does constitute a repudiation. I don't see any way that you can say that, you know, the demand that we are going to do this, we've already what we'd already negotiated out in the context of the commitment letters, how that is not a repudiation.
So what's the scope of their approval that you foresee in the commitment letters? You know, you give them a report, you give them financial, you know, audited financials, you give them other kinds of reports, perhaps environmental reports. What's the scope of modification that's there? Are these meaningless acts, or do they have any room to say we're not satisfied with one of these pieces of information given to us?
Well, it would be different if it were pieces of information that the parties had not already negotiated out.
Well, but they didn't completely negotiate out the Essien situation. They negotiated out the specific on the last 3 years, and they said, instead, we'll give you what we have. And you did give them what you had, and they didn't like it, I guess.
Well, no, that's not true. If you take the testimony,
they wanted the extra security after they saw it, so that in that sense, they didn't like it.
Well, as we say, I'm out of time, but I would encourage
that's
the,
all right.
the court to look at what the judge had to say about what was going on at Toronto, which I think they had a different opinion.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement.